When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Drill Down. We've got business stories behind stocks on the move. I'm Corey Johnson with episode number 179. Just ahead, Shoals Technology seeing a huge surge in the solar business. And how Walmart and TJ Maxx are managing a big change in supply chains, and maybe how inflation is their friend. And the only Saudi company listed in the United States, oilfield services company, National Energy Services Reunited, our guest, our interview with CEO Sherif Fahda. But first, it's sponsor time.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era. Never miss another critical event or insight ever. With Era, customize your company watch lists and track key events, mentions, filings, and more, all within an easy-to-use, customizable interface. That's Era, AIERA.com.
And there are so many ways to listen to the Drill Down podcast, not least of which iTunes and Spotify or Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn, whatever. But hit the subscribe button. That way you can catch every single show.
And the Drill Down is brought to you by Brain Trust, a global talent network that matches highly skilled technical freelancers with the world's most reputable brands. Brain Trust has helped clients like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Porsche, Under Armour, and more build agile tech teams fast at a fraction of the cost. Visit braintrust.com, that's BRAINTRUST.com, to learn more.
And welcome to the Drill Down. I'm Corey Johnson. As always, we explain not stocks, not stock stories. We're going to talk about businesses and what's happening at those businesses so we can understand the rest of the world through the eyes of those businesses. And helping me do that is Isaac Webster, our executive producer. Isaac?
I love to understand the rest of the world. Wouldn't that be great?
We're so close. We almost got it.
We're so close.
The whole world. Yeah. We do have a more global show than normal with our guest later in the show.
Absolutely, we do.
Cool story, and it kept me from doing a lot of other oil stocks, which I normally want to do. But we've got some interesting ones to drill down on today.
Well, Corey, what stocks are you drilling down on today?
Well, why don't we start with Walmart? You've heard of Walmart?
I have heard of Walmart, yes. Trades are to WMT. And shares have risen 4% over the past 5 days and 3.5% over the past 12 months.
I thought it'd be interesting time to look at this company because there's so much concern about what's going on in inflation and supply chain stuff as well. So they reported a quarter. Let's talk about the quarter briefly. Nice, decent growth for the company, in particular in grocery. Their comp store sale, because they were able to capture more market share in the grocery business, their comp store sales were up 8%, which is pretty big deal. Sam's Club was up 10%.
They had a strong stores. Yeah. They had a strong report.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it wasn't just prices going up. 8% rise in membership income at Sam's Club showed that people were shopping. And they're predicting about a 6% increase in Q4 on the top line, even though bottom line will shrink a little bit. So the question remains, what do we know about supply chains and where, you know, what does inventory mean for these guys? Because, you know, interestingly, the inventory that they have in their stores, obviously they try to turn it over as quickly as they possibly can. But inevitably, especially with the problems of supply chains over the last 3 years or 2 years, right? If we take it back to 2020 and when things got really upside down during the pandemic and lockdowns and so on, quarantines. And so it really changed the world of supply chains. We've heard so much about that. And the unwinding of that is starting to happen for these guys. So the stuff that was once clogged in the back of the supply chain started to get clogged kind of in the middle and then into the stores themselves. Even as that starts to get reduced, as they are able to raise prices at the end of it, it looks like the inventory is maybe more price, but maybe less stuff. Listen to CEO or CFO of Walmart, John Rainey.
It's important to consider, if you look back over the quarters of the year, in Q1 when we were the highest, the majority of the extra inventory was in supply chain and part of the backlog problem. And then in the second quarter, that balanced more evenly between stores and the total. And then this quarter, at the end of Q3, what we see is an increase of 12.4, but the stores are still heavy. So the inventory has moved from the supply chain to a balance, so now it's in the store. And when you look at the dollar amount that's up, about 70% of it, 3/4 of it roughly, is inflation, and the rest we can approximate to pretty significant improvements in stock over last year. Last year we were quite low, so we see a really decent improvement in stock. And then specifically in your last question, probably around something just under a billion would be what we consider excess. That's down pretty significantly, about a third of where we were at the end of Q2. So we're making improvements. Apparel and certain categories in GM are the heavy categories, and we'll continue to work through those. And, you know, just a reminder, we said at the beginning of Q1, we needed a couple of quarters to work through the inventory, and we continue to do that. And then John David did mention in his comments earlier that there is room in our forecast to continue making progress on inventory. But I was in an import center last week, and the inbound is in really good shape. The orders are in line, so I think the team have done a really nice job adjusting to the end of the year.
I kind of picture this like a snake eating a large mammal, right? It's just kind of working its way through the system here. But I think what these guys sounds like they really have worked it out, and they expect that by the fourth quarter, and they will have adjusted to those inventory issues, specifically the inflated value of those inventories, such that it won't be such a big problem next year. And it was a pretty positive report from Walmart, I thought.
Very positive. And I mean, you know, Walmart's a bellwether for the U.S. economy, right?
I did some Walmart shopping in the last month. Believe
did
it or
you?
Not, me.
Do you shop online, or did you
no,
go to
No, I was
store?
With my son at freshman in college, and we had to go supply his dorm room.
Well, where I grew up,
Walmart was perfect.
Our big claim to fame in my hometown, where I graduated high school, a very small town in Missouri, we had at the very first Supercenter ever on the planet. Yeah. Oh, huge deal. Huge deal.
Concerning.
Anyway. Corey, what is your next drill down?
I want to look at a company we've never looked at, never talked about before. Shoals Technology Group.
Shoals Technology Group trades under SHLS, and shares have jumped over 26% over the past 5 days. But if you look at a 12-month chart, they're lower by 21%. But a good week for Shoals. What's going on?
Solar. This company's in the business of solar. They provide a whole bunch of solar stuff for big, large-scale solar projects. So cable assemblies, wireless monitoring systems, junction boxes, transistor disclosure enclosures, I should say, splice boxes that separate out the power as it comes in from all the different panels and so on. They call these, in the business, it's called as EBOS. Or EBOS systems, electrical balance of system is what EBOS stands for. And this is, you know, the guts of what makes big solar arrays work. And for this company, they've seen a big increase in sales. Sales year over year of $91 million in the third quarter, which they just reported, is up 52% year over year. Earnings up 43% year over year. But the big question is, what will the impact be of the IRA? No, not the Irish Republican Army.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's where my mind went. What are you talking about? IRA?
Not the
IRS?
Retirement accounts. The Inflation Reduction Act.
Oh, yes. The Inflation Reduction Act.
The Inflation Reduction Act provided all kinds of subsidies and incentives for clean energy and solar in particular. And the combination of the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, and higher energy prices makes solar look like a really good business for the power companies to be into these large solar arrays look a lot sexier when the costs go down through subsidies and the comparisons go up because of the price differential of expensive fuel, oil and gas and so on. So how will the IRA play out? We're just starting to get some clues, and it's not a huge company, so I won't go on in $3 or $4 billion company. But here is CEO Jason Whitaker briefly about what the IRA means.
While we're still waiting on further guidance from the Treasury on certain aspects of the IRA, the bill provides many demand drivers for Shoals and the industry. First, as we discussed in our last call, we believe the increase and extension of the investment tax credit, coupled with new incentives for storage and EVs, will accelerate demand for our products. While we still don't know just how significant the effect on demand will be, initial reaction suggests that the IRA is the most significant piece of legislation for the solar industry to date.
Again, the most significant piece of legislation for the solar industry to date. Super positive for these guys.
Yeah. And, you know, we've been talking to Jason actually for a while to bring him on the show. So hopefully he will join us soon.
Well, now you make it sound like I was being nice. I didn't know you were talking to him. Well, good. He should come on the show. Or we'll make fun of his company. Yeah. No, we wouldn't do that.
Oh, wow. And that's a threat.
No, we just balls and strikes. That's all we do. Call balls and strikes.
Corey, what's your next drill down?
I want to look at TJ Maxx.
TJ Maxx trades under TJX. TJX companies and shares have risen 3% since the start of 2022 and have risen over 12% in a year.
A lot of retail. I know we just talked about Walmart. TJ Maxx, of course, the company behind Home Goods, Marmaxx, Marshalls, Sierra. They reported a quarter with revenues down about 3% to $12 billion. Same store sales down 3%. Comp store sales down 2%. But a kind of a positive report, despite those declines, maybe not least of which because they kind of lowered the bar with last quarter's results, and then were able to raise the bar and say things are going to get a little bit better in the next quarter. That's their prediction. They say that the treasure hunt shopping experience continued to resonate with customers. Do you go into these stores? You're a Marshalls guy, yes? You've mentioned that before.
I have. No? I'm not.
Ross
but,
stores.
Neither, no. But my, really? But, you know, okay. My husband is a treasure hunter, and he comes home with a lot of treasures from these stores. Yeah, I'm not that guy.
To that, there is a Home Goods in the Hamptons that is the real hookup out there. I think it's in Bridgehampton, and it's the only deal to be had on that part of
in the Hamptons.
Long Island. But I thought it was really interesting. So and I want to tie this to some broader headlines. We just had this election that produced some really surprising results where a lot of Republicans in a lot of places were running on the idea of Joe Biden and inflation are ruining the country, inflation. And it didn't seem to resonate when the votes were really tallied, even though it did in a lot of the polling. Maybe the polls were bad, and that's my contention. But I was interested to hear the comments in TJ Maxx when they talked about inflation and when they talked about where they are able to raise prices and where customers are just like, I'm not going to pay that. This is too much inflation. I'm disgusted by this. I'm not going to pay these prices. And what this company really said, and I'm going to let you listen to the CEO, Ernie Herrmann, in a second, but what they really said is that they've got a lot of price elasticity and that they are, it's a really unusual time for them because they are able to jack price points across the board, whether it's on apparel or hardline goods. And they're finding that they can just, even though their prices are going up, they're able to pass those on to customers without a lot of resistance. Here is Ernie Herrmann.
On the macro lens, with regard to the pricing, we are seeing very, very little resistance. And I would say our hit rate is in the 90%+ in terms of success on measuring it. In fact, at one point, I think Scott, in his script, talked about how our turns are essentially where they were in FY20, which is always a barometer. So we look at pre-COVID, and we get all the way down to a SKU level. So we look at categories, we look at departments, and then we go to SKU level. And obviously, we zero in on where we've adjusted the retail. And because of what's happened around us, where the retails have gone up so much significantly, we have really been so effective at it and hit extremely low resistance. So a lot more, I guess, opportunity as we move forward to keep doing it. Because we've spotted, as you can imagine, we're also spotting places where we've gone up a retail and we can go up again. So you have that dynamic, which is a little unusual because sometimes we do an intermediate price point raise and the goods, whether it's apparel or hardlines, have gone up a couple of price points, because remember, some of the inflationary hits have been more than just 2 or 3%. So there are some items that have gone up 10 or 20%, and we've only gone up the first price point. So all in all, Omar, definitely more opportunity there, if anything, in terms of pricing resistance.
So maybe what's happening here with inflation is people don't like inflation, but it's not at such a crippling level that they can't afford it, because there's also been wage inflation and people are seeing their paychecks get a little bit bigger. And people have had still on the heels of a lot of the relief that they got during COVID from the government, that maybe they're not just quite so broke that they can't afford these slightly higher prices, and that inflation wasn't the cudgel that it looked like it was going to be in the election, and also not the cudgel that will be used against TJ Maxx's different brands and different stores.
Well, the employment numbers are pretty healthy.
Yeah, that's another part of the U.S. Absolutely.
I mean, people have jobs right now. Yeah, maybe there's some inflation, but they're always looking for deals, and, you know, TJ Maxx has the deals.
Well, let's dig a little deeper into the biggest driver of inflation in our global economy, the price of oil, the price of fuel, jacked up surely by the Russian war against Ukraine and the people of Ukraine. But listen to this conversation. I thought a really interesting one with Sharif Fada. He's an oil field services company based in Saudi Arabia. It's called National Energy Services Reunited, in our fascinating interview right after this.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Brain Trust, a global talent network that matches highly skilled technical freelancers with the world's most reputable brands. Brain Trust has helped clients like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Porsche, Under Armour, and more build agile tech teams fast at a fraction of the cost. Visit braintrust.com, that's BRAINTRUST.com, to learn more.
And welcome back to the Drill Down podcast. We're joined right now by the CEO of National Energy Services Reunited, Sharif Fada. Sharif, glad to have you joining us from Houston. As we would expect from an oil field services company, I love the oil and gas industry more than any other because of its simplicity, right? Like, oil and gas is, you stick a hole in the ground, you see what comes up, and then you try to sell it for more than it cost. It's the simplest business in the world until you get into oil field services, when it starts to get complicated. So tell me what you guys do and how you help that oil and gas come out of the ground.
So we are basically, we do all the services to enable those wells to produce oil and gas. So everything from exploration to production for the operator. So the operator, basically, especially in the areas where we are in the Middle East, usually they are the government or the national oil companies. They own the oil and the gas. And basically, we do all the services. If you like, for the people, to simplify it, it's all the architecture and the plumbing of that, which is basically logging the wells, constructing the cement around the pipe, being able to get the oil out using artificial lift completion equipment. Sometimes you have to frack the well, the formation, to be able to get the gas or the oil out of the ground and then put it into the pipeline. And usually the operator does that.
And this is the kind of work that giant companies like Halliburton and Schlumberger and so on do as well, which is to say lots of different steps within the process of finding oil, drilling a well, finishing a well, and bringing it in production.
Correct. Absolutely correct. And there is a lot of electronics, if you like, and subsurface engineering. Quite complicated, but because people usually don't see it, they don't really appreciate it. But there is a lot of technological advancement that happened over the years to be able to do that. And part of it is as well is to be able to see what's underground 4 or 5 kilometers or miles in underground, and how the best way to optimize that and get this at the most economical value.
Now, I've spent a lot of time trying to understand the U.S. oil and gas market and the technologies involved there. And I haven't spent much time working on stuff in the Middle East, where your business is mostly. And certain, to be sure, you work with some of the biggest companies in the world, not just the Saudi Aramcos of the world, but all of the major integrated oil companies, the IOCs of the world, ExxonMobil, Chevron, so on. And on and on, doing about, what is it, on a trailing basis, $900 million in revenues. I'm trying to find the nicest way to say this. It seems to me that the operations in the Mideast, because there is so much oil, are not as complicated as the operations in Texas or in the Williston Basin in the U.S., or in the Marcellus Shale, where there's a lot of fracking, there's a lot of horizontal drilling, finding the oil that hasn't been exploited is much more difficult. Whereas in the Middle East, it has been traditionally simpler to find the oil, and it hasn't been as complicated, not as horizontal, and not as expensive. Is that fair? Tell me, yeah, I'm totally wrong.
No, no, it is absolutely fair. So if you like to define it, it's conventional and unconventional.
Right.
So the reservoir is basically what we call pressurized. And for the people to simplify it, then you have the normal reservoir or the traditional reservoir that is full of oil, the permeability and the rock basically is full of oil. And that oil has a very good conduit, or what we call permeability. So you drill the well. By the way, the well is high technological, which means could be offshore, could be land, could be horizontal. However, the flow of that oil and gas becomes very natural. And that's why what we call it's a green reservoir, which basically it's not green of a color of the hydrocarbon. It's basically it's easy to extract, which makes it very cost effective. So for
which
you
to say it's typically just it's like sticking a straw in the ground, and if you're in the right place, oil is going to come up.
Absolutely right. So and that's why the cost could go as low as $4 or $5 a barrel versus a $35-$40 a barrel in the US,
which you've seen in the Permian Basin or
in the because Balkan here you have to, and it has as well a lower carbon footprint to produce it because you don't frack it.
Is that changing?
It is going to change over time, but now there's still a lot of oil and gas. And obviously the whole narrative changed that abundance of oil and gas to basically leave it because of other part of the energy that will come into place, right? So there is a plenty of oil and gas that is conventional, especially in Saudi Arabia and the gas like in Qatar. I mean, for people to just to understand, Qatar has 900 TCF of gas in
trillion cubic feet.
That is how much they have. So that is enough for 100 years, right? So,
again, I told you before we started the interview, I don't care about the stock price, and I don't really need to talk about today's oil market. But it is a true fact that the conflict in Europe and in Eastern Europe and Ukraine and Russia has really changed the gas market, and probably really changed the liquefied nat gas market, which didn't maybe have as much demand. Well, that's fair enough to say, did not have the demand that it does now, and maybe never would have had that demand had it not been for a war shutting down a prolific pipeline supplying Europe.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you would not take LNG, for people to understand. You get the compressed gas, you make it liquid, it costs you a fortune, and then you have to transport it, then you have to degasify it at the station. Whether in the case of the whole Europe, they just get a pipe with gas already in it that they can connect to the house. And now they have to pay 5-6 times the price. So definitely that market would not have exploded like this. Shouldn't have been the war between Russia and Ukraine.
It's a fairly amazing development in that market that I was always so skeptical of, the LNG market. But here it is. And here we've got nat gas at which seemed like it was stuck below $3, maybe even below $2 for years and years and years, suddenly popping up this year to $10. And so the technology changes so much in the back end because there's interest in it, because there's a need for it, because the cost of LNG is suddenly a small part of what you get paid at the end.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the spot market, as you people know, in Europe now, sometimes there was an LNG that was sold at $62.
Incredible.
So it's incredible, right? And when the cost is like $2 to $3, right? So, but that's how, and the issue as well is the readiness of the degasification in Europe, which is not ready. So it's not even the problem, even if they take more.
Which is to say, let me paraphrase that, and you, once again, please tell me when I'm wrong. But essentially what you're saying is you can make all the LNG in the world, but once you get to Europe, they don't have the offload capability to take it off the ships when it gets there.
Absolutely.
And they're building it like crazy.
They are building like crazy, but it takes 2 years to do. So the Germany, to be able to compensate that, it's not going to be before 2026 when they feel adequately can replace the Russian gas. And that's why, unfortunately, people now are using coal, right? Which is, you're going worse from the climate point of view. Yeah.
And at the same time, also rushing to create renewables as well, and a faster effort to get into solar and so on. Why would a company hire your company rather than a Schlumberger or a Halliburton?
In the Middle East, is obviously they want a nationalization and a localization in a big way. We are considered national player. That's why we call ourselves that long name. And national, we are called the national champion. And obviously the abbreviation of the name is Nasr, which means the eagle in Arabic. Definitely
that name, that's again, where, being National Energy Services Reunited.
Yes. So like we're reuniting all the countries, and we are the Nasr, the eagle of all the countries. So we are local, we invest locally a lot. We hire a lot of local people. And definitely there is as well a room for everyone. You know, it's we are all today maxed out in our capacity. And I think going forward, the market is going to explode in the sense of everybody will need everyone to be able to get all this oil and gas out of the ground. I mean, there will be a lack of talent as well.
So why are you in Houston now, not joining me?
We are purely, I spend 80% of my time in the Middle East, and we just have a small headquarter here for investors. We are the only public company in the Middle East on New York, and a lot of people don't know that. There is not a single company in the Middle East in any industry on New York or NASDAQ except us. So there is obviously a lot of... a lot of people coming from our shareholders that would like to come to us. And the third part, which is important, is all the majority of the technology and the knowledge and the know-how comes from Houston. So it allows me to do a lot of partnership in the area because we are basically here. We are only five people here.
I guess that backs up what I was saying, which is that it's so much harder to get oil and gas out of the ground in the U.S. that we've had to have better technologies.
Yes, absolutely. And the majority, but the brain and everything is really in Houston, right? I mean, there was a mix between Europe and the U.S., and it's more and more toward U.S. now, obviously, because of the ESG over the past 10 years. So you only have, if you like, the R&D is between three countries in Europe now, mainly Norway, some of the old stuff in Germany, some of the electronics in France. But in the U.S., Houston is really the hub now for a lot of the R&D and the brain around oil and gas.
All right. So given the simplicity of the hydrocarbon and geological structure of the Middle East and the complications of the technology that you're acquiring in Houston and trying to understand, what's the coolest thing that's got you excited about the technologies that you're going to be able to deploy in the Middle East that'll be needed there?
We actually need all the technology because it's a matter of age.
No,
it's exactly
one.
It's pick exactly one. The aging of the field. So if you are pioneering a lot of those technology coming all the time, that's exactly what they need to be able to come up with the same production portfolio. Because the more these reservoir age, the more technology you need.
I'll use the U.S. corollary, right? Where Rockefeller found the first oil in the U.S. in Titusville, the first serious production in Titusville in western Pennsylvania, which we now call the Marcellus Shale, which is to say the Rockefeller got the easy oil out of Titusville, but the more complicated stuff, the more complicated technology had to be deployed in the same region with different geological formations, or sometimes the same ones, to squeeze those last drops, of which there were many in the Marcellus Shale.
Yes, correct. Absolutely. And you know, when you look, for example, at the horizontal drilling, today 60% of the wells in the Middle East are horizontal as well.
Really?
Not to be able to get like a very... not to be able to get a very tiny, but now some of those fields, they know, why would I wait to drill vertical and drill horizontal after that to get... Why don't I drill monster wells? So these wells sometimes produce 15,000 barrels per day. You know,
really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's ginormous. Yeah. How many zones will there be in that hydraulic, or how long will those hydraulic wells be?
10,000 lateral usually.
10,000 meters. 10,000 feet. Okay.
That's the lateral. And they drill like first around 10,000 feet into the reservoir, into the formation subsurface. Then they go laterally by 10,000 feet. And you know, some of the wells in of the gas, like in Qatar, they produce 300 million scf per day.
That's just so they will do. And how deep are those wells?
12 to 14,000 feet.
So you'll go 12 to 14,000 feet down.
And these are vertical wells.
So you'll go, so that's about 3 miles down, or almost 3 miles down, and then 2 miles horizontal.
No, some of the wells of the gas are vertical.
But the horizontal wells, wells will go horizontally almost 2 miles, which is probably a dozen fracking zones, which is unbelievable. That is as complicated as some of the horizontal wells in the Permian Basin.
Yeah, absolutely. You have everything. I mean, that's what people have to remember, because of the Middle East is so rich in oil and gas. They have everything. They have all the reservoir, all type of complexity, but they have obviously the easy stuff, that's what they're going to go after. But the gas, they do both. Very easy gas, which is like Qatar, offshore, very prolific. And they have as well the tight where they have to frack it.
Yeah, so if I'm right here, and I don't want to get too deep, but I'm already well deep into this, no pun intended. It seems like in some places in the Middle East, they're spending a lot of money to create complicated wells. Not that they have to get anything out, but they'll get so much more production out of those wells because they've found the way to just soak up every last drop under the ground. Then they'll be the most prolific wells in the world.
Yes, correct. I mean, it's a mix of both. Yes, absolutely.
Fascinating stuff. Fascinating company and a fascinating conversation. We're grateful for your time. Sherif Fahda is the CEO of National Energy Services Reunited. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
When the drill down continues, we're going to tell you one number, the bite, one number that tells us a whole lot about National Energy Services Reunited right after this.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era. With Era, give yourself an information advantage, connect directly to earnings calls and other investor events with live transcription and event intelligence. That's Era, AIERA.com.
And if you enjoy the Drill Down podcast, perhaps someone else you know might enjoy the Drill Down podcast. Tell them, tell your friends, or leave a review on Apple iTunes and let the rest of the world know what it is that you like about this show, why you have given us your valuable time, and why someone else might enjoy it as well.
And let us know what companies you think we should be drilling down on. Talk to us on Twitter and Instagram by following at DrillDownPod, and connect with us directly at our website, bizpod.net.
We're back with the Drill Down Bite, the one number that tells us a whole lot about this fascinating company, National Energy Services Reunited Corporation. What a horrible name.
Yeah. I like Nesser, though. The ticker symbol.
The Eagle.
Yeah, the Eagle.
National Energy Services Reunited. Fascinating company here. So I'll tell you what the number is. The number is one.
Okay.
And that's how many oil companies they deal with in Saudi Arabia. You know why?
Why is that, Corey?
Because there's only one oil company in Saudi Arabia. These are all national oil companies they service. So there's only one customer in every one country.
Right.
Another interesting thing. One is also the number of Academy Awards. There Will Be Blood earned for Best Actor. Did you see that movie?
Of course. Yeah, it was great.
Paul Thomas Anderson. Weird, weird 2007 movie. Didn't make a ton of money in the box office. Daniel Day-Lewis won an Academy Award for that. You can get a real understanding of how oil and gas works in that movie. Because early in that movie, should I ruin the scene?
Yes, do it.
Early in that movie, Daniel Day-Lewis's character is Daniel Plainview is the name of the character, is digging a hole in the movie. It's in New Mexico. He's digging a hole where no one thinks there's oil, and he falls and breaks his leg. And
a painful scene. Yeah.
Right. But the way he drills the oil, he digs a hole as deep as he can. Then he drops some dynamite in it and runs and hopes some oil comes up.
Yep.
And the oil business isn't much more complicated than that, really. It's just a little more technologically involved than digging a ditch with a shovel and dropping dynamite in.
So many aspects of this conversation I found fascinating. But I didn't realize NESR, NESR, was really kind of like a United Nations of these oil field services companies for the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, this is not a giant company, no. Given the size of its customers. Like I said, Halliburton and Schlumberger, much bigger, and the sounds like the services they offer are quite similar. But nonetheless, a fascinating conversation, yeah. And a, you know, an industry that is not going anywhere, and fascinating to talk about, at least to me, for these guys. And like I said, it's not a giant company. I mean, it's got a market cap of $500 million, and an enterprise value of about $1 billion. So they've got a bunch of debt too. But nonetheless, a great conversation. We're grateful to have that CEO here. And we're grateful to have you listening to this show. Isaac Webster is our executive producer. I'm Corey Johnson. Ben Wilson has stitched this together. He's our editor extraordinaire. The Drill Down is a production of the Business Podcast Network.